Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The brothers Anderson are. This is Eric, he's the oldest one. The producer who makes it fun, gotta give him the credit. He's good with the edits. He's been the driving force since they begun. Next we got brother Jay. He just the movies that they play. The sip in the middle, Jay is gonna be a little more critical, analytical when he communicates. And lastly we got Drew, the finally family member of this group. He decides if the movie's worth it. Right kind of guy, that's for certain. Three chatty brothers with a family base. Need an excuse to talk away. Dichotomy of personalities. All you really need to do is press play. One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you want to catch an episode. They talk movies till they go off on a tangent flow and maybe ramble. That's the brothers Anderson. So sit back with closed eyes, let them take you away. Unless you're driving, keep them open to that case. We got Eric, Drew, and brother Jay. Welcome you two, Not in a Creepy Way.
Welcome, this is Eric.
This is brother Jay.
And tonight we're going to talk about 2017's Darkest Hour, directed by Joe Wright, who directed 2005's Pride and Prejudice, Atonement, 2011's Hannah, and The Woman in the Window. So he's got a thing, little period pieces kind of stuff.
Okay, since this was a period piece, did you hate it?
No, I mean, it was just a historical piece, sort of mimicking real history, right? So, more or less. Had you seen this before?
Nope, never.
Okay, and you're kind of a World War II buff?
Yeah, well, I don't want to sound overly enthusiastic.
Yeah.
But
well, we've all gotten to the age where the TV may stop at the History Channel longer than it used to.
That's definitely true. Yeah, I don't want to say I'm a World War II aficionado, but I am. I'm always interested in the history of how we got where we're at, and some of and how we survived, because I look at today and I don't know how we're still surviving. So it amazes me some of the things that have transpired. And obviously this is fictionalized to a great degree,
but as it turns out.
Yeah. So
I guess just to start it off, this is a story about Winston Churchill at the beginning of World War II, just before the fall of France or during the fall of France. And leading up to the Dunkirk lift.
Yes. Now, have you seen The Crown?
I have not.
I think my difficulty watching this movie, because I've seen the four seasons of The Crown that are out, John Lithgow plays Churchill.
Oh, wow.
And so I kept seeing Gary Oldman as John Lithgow, and it was really distracting.
Oh, that's funny.
So it was. It kept taking me right out of. I had to make a conscious effort to stop myself from doing that.
That's interesting because. So I would guess that if you were a Brit, you would compare Gary Oldman to Winston Churchill, but I don't have any. I mean, I've heard the recordings of some of the speeches because they're legendary, but it's not like I have heard a lot of or even have any great affection for Winston Churchill. So the fact that he had a kind of a pronounced lisp was kind of surprising to me. And then later, flipping around Winston Churchill, as he was always embarrassed about that lisp. Sorry, I have a speech impediment that it keeps me from saying the word lisp. So he was self-conscious about his lisp until he realized that the lisp made him sound more homey. So he actually had dentures made that could have cured his lisp, but instead left it in place. Huh. So he had them make messed up dentures on purpose, which is kind of weird.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a political move, I suppose.
Yeah. So I see Gary Oldman playing Winston Churchill, and I'm just happy to forget he's Gary Oldman for a while. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I think he did a great job. I mean, didn't he win an Oscar for this?
Did he? Won two Oscars. Oh, wow. I did not know that. Hang on. Winner Oscar, best performance by actor in a leading role, Gary Oldman.
Yep.
Winner, best achievement in makeup and hairstyling, Kazuhiro David Malinowski, Lucy Sibbick.
Nice.
Nominated Best Motion Picture of the Year, Best Achievement in Cinematography, Best Achievement in Costume Design, Best Achievement in Production Design. Gary Oldman won the BAFTA for Best Leading Actor, and they were nominated for a whole bunch of BAFTAs.
Sure.
Gary Oldman won the SAG Award, AARP.
Well, it's funny.
Oh, we are there, aren't we?
We're almost there. We're getting closer. Closer every day. And still, I'm a 19-year-old kid when I deal with my parents. It's so funny. But, or at least I feel that way.
I've gotten over that.
I mean, not in a bad way. I'm not complaining. But remind me, I'll tell you a story. And listeners, by this, I mean parents. I'll tell the story on the pod. It's fine. So, should we dive into the movie?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, how much of this history... Like, I found that when I watched Dunkirk, I didn't know that history so much, you know, because it didn't really involve us. So I think they glossed over that to focus on things like, oh, I don't know, Pearl Harbor and D-Day.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know of Dunkirk until I'd listened to an audiobook that starts one of the, there's a series, it's a trilogy of books. I think we've discussed it before in the podcast, but one of the books starts with one of the characters landing. It's a time travel book, but they landed at the beach of Dunkirk.
Oh, so, okay.
It's a universe in this book series. It's set completely in.
Is it this Outlander thing where the lady goes off and has sex with somebody 200 years earlier?
No, it's about time travel people who are living in the future that go back in the past to observe history and write history correctly and correct things when the timeline has been corrupted.
Oh, okay. So like Voyager.
Kind of, yeah.
We must have had this whole conversation.
We did.
Okay,
we did.
Yeah.
I think Connie Willis, I want to say, is the author. Oh. I don't know. I have to look it up.
I wonder what she's talking about.
Okay, that was funny.
Thank you. Just wondered.
Yes. Yeah, okay.
Nice.
Doomsday Book, To Say Nothing of the Dog, Blackout All Clear. So those, I think that's the series.
Okay.
The University of Oxford series is actually what it's called. So anyway, they're long books. At least they are a lot of audio. They're well worth it.
Good. Yeah. I'm always looking for something that will, like, pull me in. Except much like movies, if the audiobook seems overly long just by looking at it, I'm like, oh, I can't commit to this.
Really?
Like, I can't commit to a 40-hour audiobook or a 30-hour audiobook.
That's funny. I'm the opposite. I feel like a 6-hour investment in a book is puny. I bought that Hiro Murakami, I forget his first name. Hiroku Murakami. Anyway, that one Q84, which is like 48 hours long.
Yes.
Oh, that was amazing.
But it was also naughty, right? So you had to turn down the volume when you were at stoplights.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. I can't commit, man. Okay. So again, I don't know the history here. So I would imagine your notes may correct some things. I mean, I know the one thing was completely invented for this.
Funny thing, would you like to know? I took no notes.
Oh, nice. Okay.
I intentionally took no notes. I watched two movies this week, 2 days in a row, Monday and Tuesday this week, this one, and then my next week movie with Drew, which is The Eyes of Tammy Faye.
Nice.
And I took no notes for either. And
should I watch Eyes of Tammy Faye?
I can't really answer that. It depends on how much.
Did you enjoy it?
I did.
Okay.
I did.
Okay. Well, so
I took no notes for this.
Nice. Well, okay. So I have a plot summary. So the movie starts May 1940, and the opposition Labour Party in Parliament demands the resignation of British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, played by Ronald Pickup from the Best Exotic Marigold Hotel and The Mission, for being too weak in the face of the Nazi onslaught. Have you been paying attention to the British Parliament this week?
No.
Well, I think maybe in a week and a half, they're going to have a confidence vote in the PM, and Boris Johnson may have another opportunity to be booted out.
That would just be terrible.
Well, he's pretty slippery. He may stay, but it is very interesting. Because again, they have 1,000 years of, well, not of the parliament probably, but they have a very long tradition of how they do stuff. That just seems very strange. But of course, our government is also very strange. I realize there are no clean hands in this whole thing.
I don't even know that we have a government at this point. I think we just have a bunch of arguing classes who are fighting for financial control of everything.
I read an article today.
We're off the rails.
That's really. Okay. It's like, this is kind of what this is going to be about, I think, just because it involves politics. But I read an article about people. There was some sort of university that did a study of who's the most likely to be taken in by like conspiracy theories like QAnon, like political conspiracy theories. And what they found was it doesn't actually, I mean, these days, people who call themselves conservative, there's probably a higher percentage of those who will fall into the QAnon trap or whatever. But that's not the deciding factor. It's not even like followers of Donald Trump. It's basically people that have that are less conscientious. So if you don't like care about your fellow man, you're more liable to get sucked into conspiracy theories and believe that it was a plandemic and masks don't work and adrenochrome, baby harvesting, you know, that kind of stuff. So anyway, it was fascinating. It's like it had much less to do with party affiliation. And conservative or liberal, and much more to do with, again, how they cared about their fellow man, which I believe is what conscientiousness is. I hope so. So the reason why I bring that up is because, you know, again, it's pretty contentious. And at this time, Neville Chamberlain, prime minister, you know, he had already been like his policy of appeasement. He thought he could negotiate with Hitler.
Because that worked well for all the other countries.
Well, that's the thing. And Winston Churchill, part of how he made his bones, so to speak, although, again, he was the first lord of the Admiralty. He already had a bunch of military stuff behind him, which we will talk about later.
Not all successful.
Some very successful, just yes. Not necessarily humanitarian. anyway,
kidding.
But yeah, you're right. Yep. Yeah. No. You're right. But also, yeah, unsuccessful in some ways. And so he came in. Oh, basically, the Tories, which again, that's the Neville Chamberlain, were being criticized by the Labour Party because the Tories were too weak in the face of Nazi onslaught. And Chamberlain tells the Conservative Party colleagues he wants Lord Halifax, played by Stephen Delane from Game of Thrones, Spy Game, and Mel Gibson's Hamlet 1990, as his successor. But Halifax doesn't feel like the time is right. So Chamberlain decides to choose the only man whom the opposition parties will accept as the leader of a national government, Winston Churchill, Gary Oldman. And he actually, again, he is in the public spotlight at this time because he predicted the danger of Adolf Hitler before the war even started. So he was already anti-Hitler to begin with, which is a good thing. All the bad things we're going to say about him later, correctly picking Hitler as the bad guy is a positive trait of Mr. Churchill. So the next morning, Germany invades the Low Countries, and Churchill tries to dismiss his new secretary, Elizabeth Layton, played by Lily James, from Pride, Prejudice, and Zombies, and Baby Driver, for mishearing him, which earns him a rebuke from his wife, Clementine, played by Kristen Scott Thomas from The English Patient, Four Weddings and a Funeral, and Gosford Park. So I thought the relationship between Winston and Clementine was very sweet in this movie, because it does portray him as sort of old man set in his ways, kind of grumpy, and she comes off as, again, like maybe the power behind the throne.
She's a little overwrought, but yeah. Well,
she keeps his spirit going. That's how at least I thought she was portrayed. I really appreciated the portrayal of King George, Ben Mendelsohn from Rogue One, Captain Marvel, and The Dark Knight Rises. I thought his performance was good and the character was strong.
Yeah.
And again, everything I know about King George is from The King's Speech.
Which is a good movie.
Yeah. But King George the Sixth distressed Churchill due to his support for his brother Edward during the abdication crisis, reluctantly invites him to form a government. Because in a parliamentary system, what you need to do is you need enough people to have a majority and form a government. So it's not unlike our system where we have just two parties. There's a bunch of parties in the parliamentary system, and you just had to get like cobbled together a coalition. But unfortunately, if part of that coalition breaks away, then you could suddenly be out of power. And that's where we have like the shadow government, like the opposing parties, kind of equal parts. Anyway, I'm already over my skis in my knowledge. Yeah, so I thought that was portrayed really well, that neither Churchill nor the king, neither of them anticipate having anything to do with one another, and they're just both just sort of gritting their teeth and hoping to avoid each other. I mean, they're required to meet once a week, but that's it. So, Churchill has a poor reputation in Parliament because of his record in the Admiralty, his role in the Gallipoli campaign in the First World War, his views on India, Russian Civil War, and his past defection to the Liberal Party. So Parliament reacts coolly to Churchill's first speech, promising blood, toil, sweat, tears and sweat, and Chamberlain and Halifax are appalled by Churchill's refusal to negotiate for peace. And they plan to resign from the government to force a vote of no confidence.
They're kind of conspiring.
Oh, yeah.
Sedition, in a way.
Again, because it's a different system.
Yeah,
I
suppose.
Yeah, it's more like they can force a no-confidence vote, and then that would make them legitimately able to make Halifax the next prime minister. And Churchill appointed them to the war cabinet, you know, which he didn't have to do.
That was strategic, though.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So Churchill visits the French prime minister, who thinks that Churchill's delusional for not admitting that the Allies are losing the Battle of France. That's the thing, is that there's part of what was going on was trying to keep the morale of the citizenry up. The French president is like, or French prime minister is like, we're getting our asses handed to us. You can't keep telling people we're winning. And then Churchill is pissed off at the French because they don't have a plan to counterattack. They're like, yeah, we had the Maginot Line and they sort of sidestepped it, so we didn't really have a plan B that seemed like a really good plan A. So U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt, who we only hear the voice of, and who plays the voice? Do you know who plays the voice?
No.
That's David Strathairn.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But he is sympathetic to Winston Churchill, wants to help, but of course, the United States Congress at this time is completely isolationist.
Yeah.
They actually enacted the Neutrality Act, and so they can't officially support the British. In fact, the British had ordered a bunch of planes, and the United States can't deliver them because of the Neutrality Act. So they said, well, if we park them right across the Canadian border, you can maybe, I don't know, throw a rope over and tug them yourself into Canada and then transport them from there. But we can't officially deliver them to Canada. And then Churchill delivers a radio address where he implies that the Allies are advancing in France, which they are not. So the king is not happy about that. And then Halifax and Chamberlain are trying to they're plotting against Churchill as far as so Halifax could take the prime ministership. But also they're trying to advocate for this sort of backroom deal where they have Mussolini negotiate, or the Italians negotiate kind of between them and the Germans. And at this point, there's the British Expeditionary Force is trapped at Dunkirk, Dunkirk and Calais. And we've seen the movie Dunkirk, so we know how that ends. It's not good in the beginning of it.
I was going to say, we haven't seen a movie on Calais, but I think that's just a lot of explosions and death.
Yeah, they sold out Calais. They said basically fight strong and divert the enemy so that we can try to get your buddies out.
Yeah, die trying.
Yeah, we're not going to be coming for you, though. So, you know, chin up and all that.
Stiff upper lip.
Yeah. And Churchill orders Brigadier Nicholson and Clay to lead the 30th Infantry Brigade in a rearguard action to distract the enemy and buy time for Dunkirk to evacuate. And this is where the secretary tells, Churchill's personal secretary says that her brother is killed during the retreat, which is, of course, very sad. And so this whole thing in France causes the war cabinet to support negotiating with Germany. And under heavy pressure, Churchill agrees to consider a negotiated peace, but ends up choking on his words as he's trying to dictate the letter. So that's all very dramatic. But during this whole thing, King George unexpectedly visits Churchill. He says he will support him, which is unexpected by Churchill.
I think the movie tries to portray that he was so horrified and repulsed at the idea of fleeing his country for the safety of Canada that he would rather be taken captive and have the monarchy attacked and fall than be ruling from absentia.
Well, and that's kind of what, you know, like negotiating with Hitler would have meant that Hitler would have all the cards. Like they would be basically just pre-negotiating their defeat. Yeah. And then if war was to come directly to their island, yeah, the king, there was the plan for the king to go to Canada.
Yeah.
Cause so you know, king, a monarchy king, can't lose their king.
King was not going to.
Well, yeah.
That's the impression that the movie gives. King was not going.
So, so unexpectedly, Churchill has an ally in the king. You know, Churchill thinks he's been outmaneuvered by fate and just the fact that they are getting their asses kicked. And also, America won't come to help because of the Neutrality Act. I mean, it's all very, I mean, I'm not, you know, you only have the resources that you have, right? So,
well, sure. Yes.
Well, you know, World War II is where America became a superpower. Anyway, so as Churchill's trying to come up with this speech about negotiating, he just can't do it. And then buoyed by the energy of the king, he is still revising his speech on his ride to Parliament to give a speech.
To the point where his secretary is typing on a typewriter in the car.
Yes.
Which is kind of amazing because, you know, you couldn't do that today. Nobody uses a manual typewriter.
No, I mean, but somebody would have a laptop in the car for sure.
You would hope.
But yeah.
But you wouldn't have the clickety-clack.
No, that's true. Well, I don't know. I know a guy with a keyboard that's pretty loud. Very satisfying.
Touche. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. So this is the part where this is just like pure fantasy, where Churchill leaps out of his car and goes and rides the underground for the first time. By the way, the part about giving the V for victory sign backwards is true, though, apparently.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So, which is kind of hilarious.
Oops.
But yeah, in this telling, he goes down to the tube and takes the tube to Parliament and along the way has a conversation with the everyday Brit. Just the man on the street. Be him man, woman, or brown person. which they kind of leaned on a little bit. This gives him a little bit more like historical cred for people who are not paying too much attention. But yeah, so he decides, you know, he says that yes, they would rather fight to the last man than to surrender. So that's where he goes and ends up, he goes and addresses the outer cabinet.
I was going to say, he pulls some sleight of hand.
Yeah.
Actually, it was a good, it's a nice political maneuver in the movie. I don't know how realistic it was, but it was, you know, made for a nice maneuver.
First, Churchill goes and talks to the outer cabinet and other members of Parliament and kind of rallies their support. And then he ended up with the small boat evacuation. Operation Dynamo is successful. So as he's preparing to address Parliament, Halifax asked Chamberlain to continue with their plan to resign. But here's where Chamberlain is going to appease every opportunity, apparently, because he's like, let's just listen to what he has to say first.
Yeah,
because I mean, Jamerlin he's not portrayed as being dumb here. He's kind of seeing which way the wind is blowing.
Also, he's dying.
Well, that's true. Yes, he has terminal cancer, but so he can't tell anybody about it. So
he's pretty much just kind of riding the wave until he isn't alive anymore. So I don't know that I'd be making deals with a guy that's, you know, ready to shuffle off his mortal coil, because he's going to be all kinds of full of emotions and perhaps decision-making trees.
Well, and of course, Churchill's chicken. You know, the speech that ends the movie, his "We shall fight on the beaches" speech, it's probably called something else officially. But, you know, I'm very familiar with that speech. Like, I could recite probably half of it just from memory, but not from history class or from quality movies, but instead from the band Iron Maiden. Because I think they play it in the beginning of maybe Aces High.
We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
It's a good speech. I mean, it's got everything. It is one of the great speeches in history. And of course, he exits the chamber to cheers and enthusiastic waving of everybody. So at the conclusion of the movie, it states that Churchill would remain prime minister for the rest of the war. And then promptly get booted from office. But then they don't mention he then gets promptly reelected. So, you know,
So not much has changed.
I would say, much like the American government, sometimes, yeah, things are crazy. So, so this portrays Churchill as a lovable curmudgeon who had his moment of doubt and yet remained strong and with the blessing of the king, or the, maybe not blessing, but the support of the king, ended up rallying a nation, and his words changed the tide of the war, more or less. But hey, they won. So, woohoo. Yeah. I mean, we won too. Yes,
luckily. I was going to say, it was kind of a worldwide effort.
Yeah, as it turns out.
Hence the whole world war.
Yeah. So you have no notes, you said.
I took no notes.
Okay. So do you have thoughts before we dive into the history of Winston Churchill?
My thoughts. First of all, it was a pretty movie.
Oh, yeah.
It looked great.
It was well-paced, too.
It was. Some of the war footage, though, the CGI was a little meh. That wasn't too distracting. But it seemed to me, and this movie was, what, 2 hours long?
Yeah, something like that.
It wasn't tight. It wasn't a tight movie.
Okay.
There was some fluff here and there that I was unsure was it important to the story. The infighting between, what is it, Halifax and...
Well, Chamberlain and Halifax were on the one side.
So the infighting, or I shouldn't say infighting, their kind of rendezvous encounters and meetings and whatnot were just kind of... It just seemed kind of really superfluous. Like, we already knew they were conspiring. Yeah.
They weren't tension heighteners?
I didn't think so. Did you?
No, not really. I mean, but because I know how it ends. I mean, we know.
I guess maybe that's part of the problem. I watch movies about the war, and I'm still fascinated to watch it. So I don't know. This movie was a fine movie. It didn't Dunkirk, right? It's dramatized. I realize that. But at least I felt something at the end of Dunkirk. At the end of this movie, I was just kind of like, eh.
Well, there were real emotional stakes in Dunkirk.
I guess that's true.
Yeah. And there weren't as many emotional stakes in this.
I think maybe that's the thing. I guess the movie never gives you the sense of peril that the characters in the movie seem to think is their peril coming.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
That didn't translate to me. I think that's really trying to articulate that in a really clumsy way. But you're right. Dunkirk was, you felt in peril in that movie.
Yeah, because your characters were on the beaches.
Right.
Yeah.
This didn't have that kind of gravity. So it was an abstract political movie.
Yes.
And so it just, even with the war footage, it just didn't, it was a little hollow.
Well, all of our main characters are in their ivory towers.
Yeah.
So if the director would have done a little bit of Tarantino, have you seen Inglourious Bastards?
No.
Well, that was a movie about World War II where they killed Hitler in a theater. yeah. So a little bit of revisionist history, wish fulfillment kind of history, which I understand is what happens in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood too, but I haven't seen that movie. So
I think it's on my list.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of Tarantino'd out.
Maybe I haven't seen the last couple Tarantino movies.
I think much like Jim Morrison, Tarantino is a younger Eric's passion. Although, again, like Pulp Fiction is still a brilliant movie.
I think my problem with Tarantino is I have changed. He has not.
Maybe that's it.
That's what I get from it. Because after I've seen a couple movies, it's like I've seen a Tarantino movie. So the next Tarantino movie is just different characters, but it's the same. I expect the same thing, so I don't have any desire. Yeah. It doesn't hold any suspense for me or interest. And it's not that he's not skilled. He's got talent, but it just doesn't appeal.
Yeah, well, yeah. And
we are getting old.
No, well, I mean, and that's the thing. But so is he. See, that's the thing is like, yeah. And he's a little older than us, which actually I mean, his later movies especially are kind of art pieces. And again, I haven't seen like Hateful Eight.
Yeah, I haven't.
So I don't, you know, but there, my understanding is that, you know, he's not afraid, much like, say, Stanley Kubrick, maybe he's got the auteur thing of, you know, he doesn't care about the fact that it could be a 3-hour movie. You know, he's going to tell the story with as many characters and many digressions as he wants. And it's going to all be shot in 70mm and or anamorphic or whatever. And yeah, so I don't know. Maybe a little of that goes a long way. The pretentiousness of Kubrick I can see in say, Tarantino. But you know what? Okay, so there's a podcast called With Gorley and Rust. And it started out as a podcast called In Voorhees We Trust with Gorley and Rust, because it's Matt Gorley and Paul Rust, who are improv/comedians, and they were talking about every single Friday the 13th movie. Okay. And then they moved on to the Halloween franchise, and then they moved on to a bunch of other franchises. Like, I think now they're doing Scream, but they had a series of one-offs, and one of them was like three, and they called themselves the Cozy Cast. Because they don't make any pretension. They're going to have a 3.5-hour chit-chat with them. And they'll ease into the subject by making, like, silly jokes. And just kind of low, like, they're not bombastic at all. They're just super friendly and cozy or whatever. But they're not afraid of being silly. Anyway. But I listened to their Eyes Wide Shut episode. Mm-hmm. And it is like a 3.5-hour love letter to Eyes Wide Shut. And it made me think about some stuff. It almost made me want to watch the movie again. And then I remembered, wait.
that piano plinking.
Yeah. Well, But they loved it so much, and I think it's because they really are into like the Kubrickiness or the Kubrickness of the whole thing, and of course the fact that they had to do like you know hundreds of takes for every episode, and it was you know a relationship that ended up crumbling under the weight probably of this crazy schedule, 400 days of shooting, yeah. That's wild. But anyway, it was fascinating to listen to them talk about it because they were maybe the first people that I listened to that, like, Paul Rust genuinely loves the movie. Like, we'll put it in the top several Kubrick movies, which is wild. Also, I'm curious, because The Clockwork Orange,
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I like that movie.
Like, I've never seen it.
Yeah, I think I found it super boring, especially at the turn. And I kind of well, you know, if I remember correctly, I know what it's doing, but it is all style over substance, and that bores me.
Well, I think by the time you would have watched it, though, you would have already watched so much that would have been beyond it.
Well, I mean,
having not seen the movie, I'm making my opinion out of
cloth. It actually, you know, the beginning of the movie is crazy because it's like Malcolm McDowell and they're all talking about like ultra violence and it's all weird sex and violence and then like really like brutal rape and stuff. And then it takes a turn and it kind of goes back on itself. It turns back on itself. Like it's on purpose. It's all, you know, it's doing a thing for sure. And I haven't read the book, so I don't know. But yeah, it's so it was
the book.
It was so because it was like censored or banned or whatever. It had that titillation of oh, this must be great because it's you know a master craftsman making this thing that's yeah censored or so over the edge, like entirely provocative on purpose, pushing all the buttons. But I don't want to watch Caligula either, you know. That's like a cutting edge. I think that's Malcolm McDowell too, and Alan Mirren and orgies and a horse and all sorts. And then actually, actual pornographic elements like cut into it because I think Bob Guccione was one of the producers.
Oh, God.
But you know that again, that's a crazy art house thing too. But I don't have any desire to see that either.
Bob Guccione was Penthouse.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Larry Flint was Playboy.
No, Larry Flint was Hustler.
Oh.
Hugh Hefner was Playboy.
Oh.
Get your pornographers right there.
Sorry.
Yeah. Oh, remember those old days? Okay, so, sorry. Going back to Winston Churchill here.
Waxing nostalgic for the pornographers.
Well, that's the thing is, as you know, we're now, you know, in the news recently, you have all of like Hugh Hefner's, you know, when he was like in his 80s or whatever, his wives or girlfriends or whatever are now, you know, many years after his death, all saying how horrible it was. And they were like being sex trafficked kind of, or they sold themselves into white slavery because of how horrible it was. This is just part of the, well, of course, like, what did you think you were getting? And yet I don't want to blame the victim.
Right.
But, you know, I read a story in the newspaper. Isn't that great? I don't do that either. I read a story online someplace that talked about how Hillary Clinton is maybe thinking about running.
No.
And it's like, oh, no, that's what my first thought was. No.
No,
no, no, no. First of all, Jeffrey Epstein should probably eliminate all the Clintons for a while because no one wants to open that box. Pardon the pun. Wake up the dog.
He wasn't asleep. That's the thing. That noise he makes.
Yeah.
Is when he's angry and wants attention.
Oh, okay.
So he's fully awake. Oh, he does that when he wants attention. And most of the time, you know, he's conditioned to us.
Yeah, of course.
When he does that, I respond. So normally I respond by giving him attention, except that this time he realized as I was reaching back that it was not going to be the attention he wanted, so he immediately stopped.
Yeah. No, what you did worked, for sure.
Yeah. As he walks up, you're going to hear his nails on my glass floor mat now. Yeah.
Anyway, so, sorry, I was kind of, again, I don't know why I'm like beating around the bush verbally, but I should take a line from Churchill and prepare my words more carefully. But these days, you know, in 2022 especially, we are tearing down statues of heroes past because of their problematic nature.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, it's still kind of appalling that our money has slave owners on it, you know. But, and there's a whole argument about history and putting things in historical perspective, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, Winston Churchill has some issues. Like, he was a big fan of eugenics. He wanted to make sure that they sterilized mentally ill people.
That's problematic.
Yeah. He also, he was, like, racist is a strong word. And like I kind of fall into this problem when we talk about H.P. Lovecraft, who he was a serious racist even of the time, and I think Winston Churchill was too. Churchill, pretty much his, and of course he had a lot of writings, but his writings were, you know, he claimed not to be racist, and yet he thought that the British sort of just won the genetic lottery, and pretty much. Any third world country were just barbarians.
How much of that is the elevation of the royal ruling class and their affection for the monarchy, though?
Well, they made themselves believe they
were supreme because they elevated themselves by being a royalty.
Yeah. Well, and so he mused at one point that that keep England white was a good slogan.
Oh.
He also, see, of course, again, one thing about British history is the colonialism. They ruled India, and he didn't have very many nice things to say about Gandhi. And he also, like, there was during World War II, actually, I think in 1943, maybe, there was a huge famine in Bengal in India, right? Famine, like, people were dying of starvation. And yet, that's where the British were importing their rice. And Churchill's thing was like, yeah, no, you're supporting the war effort. You need to keep sending us rice. We don't care if those people are starving.
Yeah.
And then, of course, he was definitely a Zionist in that he definitely thought that the Israelis deserved, like, their homeland or, you know, their own state. Of course, he also believed that that it was in Palestine, so he didn't think much of the Palestinians. And so, there was some kind of hearing or whatever where he was testifying regarding the right of Britain to decide the destiny of Palestine. He's quoted as saying that he does not admit that a great wrong has been done to the red Indians of America or the black people of Australia. He does not admit that a wrong has been done to these people by the fact that a stronger race, a higher grade race, a more worldly wise race has come in and taken their place. So, yeah, he's not going to apologize for that. Hey, we're better than them.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and then, of course, war crimes. I mean, you know, he was happy enough to use like poison gas on barbarous people. Bunch of brown people got gassed. He was okay with it. Now, granted, this is in World War I, so it was before the outlaw use of chemical weapons, but still. And there are plenty of Churchill, I guess, explainers or apologists, depending on your perspective, who will suggest that this is just, you know, these were common views of the times, blah, blah, blah. But no, he seemed pretty, like, he definitely had thoughts about superior races, even though he disagreed with Hitler. You know, and again, yeah, anti-concentration, although it was funny. Wait, hold on. Sorry, I stepped in a little bit. During the Boer War, actually, he created some of the first concentration camps in South Africa. But that's a very different deal, so, you know. But again, the United States history of concentration camps is also not spotless there, so. Anyway.
A little problematic.
Yeah, and so, of course, Hitler was, you know, killing 6 million undesirables. And Stalin, you know, there were 20 million Russians killed during their part of the war. So, you know, what's a little firebombing of Dresden? You know, what's a little bit of civilian bombing? You know,
Nazi again, schmazi.
Well, let's see. Luckily, his side won. what was it? It was The Fog of War, the Errol Morris documentary, where they were talking about World War II and dropping the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And mm-hmm. how that, yeah, if we had lost the war, we would have been, they all would have been tried for war crimes. But they won the war, so, you know.
Well.
So, luckily, I don't have to salute any statues of Winston Churchill, or any statues, as a matter of fact. And yet, the movie was perfectly enjoyable to watch. I mean, it's not my history, so it didn't, like, bring me to tears to hear that great speech at the end. But it is a good speech, for sure.
So. Yeah.
So maybe that's it. Maybe I just didn't hit me in the feels because it's not my history.
I guess that could be.
But Dunkirk, that hit you in the feels because you cared about those individual characters.
You did.
You cared about Robert Pattinson.
There's a lot more depth in the characters in Dunkirk.
You even cared about Kenneth Branagh, which for me is a big stretch.
I know.
Yeah.
Scissors everywhere.
And not a drop to drink. it's not just scissors, man. It's over the top Russian accents.
Yeah, but that was a great movie.
I mean, you know, when Branagh's performance is viewed through the Peruvian mirror, you see that, you know,
it's, Peruvian window.
Yeah, sorry, the Peruvian window. That yeah, I can't even get my own quote right. That's how sad that is. So, final thoughts. What's your grade?
This is, it's hard to grade. I'd say it's like a B minus-ish. It's not an A movie. It's just not. Agreed. I mean, I think everybody was giving a good performance, and I think the sets look good, and, you know, I think the dialogue was good. The story was just kind of meh. And so as a movie, it was just kind of a meh movie.
You know, I agree. I was leaning toward B plus, but I think I'll move to just a B. Because I think they did what they set out to do. They just weren't going to be pulling at your heartstrings at any point. So that wasn't what this movie was about. So then you question about what is the movie about? I mean,
yeah.
I guess it's just about defining Churchill under the terms that you want to define him.
Well, I guess that's one of the things. What was this movie trying to say? What was the overriding point of this movie?
I think this time, if I remember correctly. Either around this time or short. No, I think it was just before this time. Yeah. I think I want to say like in 2015 or 2010 or whatever, they actually had like a vote on the greatest Brit of all time. And Winston Churchill came in number one, like beating William Shakespeare and other amazing characters in history.
Mm. Interesting.
And that may be a recency bias because, you know, when you have...
Bodium with boat face.
Well, when you also have, you know, 1,000 years of history, you know, you're going to probably, some of the people will fall off in the early part of it.
It's going to have a very definitive curve.
What they need to resurrect, like, Disraeli and whatever, all those other, I can't even think of, like, the people, the famous, like, what, kings of history?
Yeah.
Anyway. That's deep. See, my British history is not the greatest.
Well, I mean, fair. I think, like, again, I think that was part of my problem is this movie, the point of this movie didn't occur to me. And the title of the movie didn't match.
Well,
does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, this was The Darkest Hour.
Was it? Because it didn't seem dark.
Well, that's true. You're right. You didn't get the gravity of it.
Yeah, I think that's why this movie didn't connect with me. Again, it wasn't an awful movie. It was 2 hours worth. I mean, it was fine.
If memory serves, it got darker. Like, you know, rockets were landing on British soil and they were bombing London and stuff.
Yeah, but so. it didn't, again, that didn't, I don't know.
Well, but not yet. See, that's all after this movie.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Anyway, yeah. So, I mean, I was glad we watched it. You know, as it turns out, I'm glad to see Gary Oldman, although maybe history won't treat him very well either. Although it's funny, like Winston Churchill had all these horrible beliefs, but you know, so does Eric Clapton apparently. So come on. I guess you don't want Prime Minister Clapton though, right? You need a steady hand at the rudder, not a slow hand, apparently. Okay, so housekeeping.
So I made it through that Murdoch Murders podcast, Drek.
By the way, we had, so unbeknownst to our listeners, after we recorded last week, I was listening to My Favorite Murder, and they mentioned a podcast called The Murdoch Murders. Murdaugh is how they spell Murdoch.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are like 25 episodes. One dropped last night, right?
Did it?
Yeah, I think so.
I had moved on.
And
I was up to date until last night then, which yeah. That just pisses me off.
Yeah. Well, it's addictive.
It's not.
It's real-time storytelling.
The only thing that the only reason that I finished it is because I'm a completionist and I had to finish it because I'm so irritated at it at this point. Like, I just
okay. So let me frame it real quick, and then give me sure. your response. So,
yes.
So the way it was introduced to me through My Favorite Murder, so it was introduced to me and millions of other people, is that it's this reporter from South Carolina who works for this little independent news organization, and she's been following this Murdoch family in South Carolina for years, and it's it's all like. I think this family has been the part of like the local prosecutors for like 100 years. And they also kind of have the law set up where the judges are very favorable to victims of large corporations. Like they give out big judgments.
Yeah.
So the idea is, you know, if you are wronged by Walmart, you can sue Walmart in this county if Walmart has a presence in this county, which, by the way, is why Walmart is not in this county. this family has a bunch of sway, let's say. And, you know, apparently you didn't mess with these people because they're politically connected. And then all this shit happened. And this is all in the last couple of years. This isn't like ancient history. So it's got like, what, like 3 murders at least. and maybe an attempted murder, but maybe like a bogus kind of fraud thing. And the podcast started out, you can obviously tell it is as janky as we were when it started. She is obviously recording at her kitchen table with her fiance or her boyfriend at the time, future fiance, is the quote engineer during the thing. But she had obviously didn't have a lot of experience being a podcaster, which I don't fault her for because this was not a professional podcast. But it's funny because so she talks about the story, and then episode 2, she starts off because actually she starts off talking about the podcast. Like normally you would start off with your news story and then you talk about the podcast. Now, granted, we violate this thing all the time, but we're not delivering news. Well, this is just a chitty chat thing we're doing.
I think my problem with her podcast is that she keeps saying, I'm a reporter, I'm a reporter, I'm a reporter. That's fine when you're reporting news. Your podcast is not news. You have so much conjecture and opinion and bias, and that's fine. It's your podcast. Stop referring to your journalism because they're not even in the same ballpark, and you're trying to legitimize one from the other, and it doesn't work like that. And I think that's what most irritates me.
Okay. So her journalistic ethics annoy you.
I don't think it's not journalistic ethics. I think, having not read her journalism, I don't know about her journalistic ethics. I'm saying as a podcaster, she's leaning on her journalism as some kind of validation for her podcasting. And
But she would tell you she's doing a journalism podcast.
Yeah, absolutely not.
Okay.
She's not unbiased. She's not presenting both sides.
Well, no, you don't have to be, don't fall into the Fox News thing. You don't have to provide both sides of a story.
She has a very clear bias, and she's already made up her mind. She's not delivering facts.
Yeah.
She's delivering opinion of facts interpreted.
Oh, yeah.
Which is not journalism. it's editorializing. Yeah, and that's
it's completely valid. Editorializing.
Yeah. I'm not saying it's again. I'm not saying she's not valid in her opinions. Knock yourself out. But I think that she keeps going back to this journalism. No, it's not. It's really not.
So that because true crime podcasts are a dime a dozen, she's trying to get some extra cred by being a real journalist.
Sure. What you're saying.
Yes. Not just a web sleuth.
I would agree with that.
And she's acting like a real journalist. Like, she's going to court hearings. She is calling sources. She is doing whatever. But yeah, you're right. She definitely does have an axe to grind.
Here's the thing, though. She's doing that in her journalistic career because it's furthering her news stories and story reporting. It has the side benefit of launching into this side project she has.
Yeah, which now has become one of the most popular new podcasts on Apple Podcasts.
Yeah. So, anyway.
Which, by the way, I was going to say the second episode is delightful because she starts talking about how, you know, she thanks people for listening. She's excited it's becoming popular, except for all the people that this is because this is the week she learned what vocal fry was and all the people that hate her voice and say she needs to stop sounding like Kim Kardashian. And she's exasperated. She's like, look, I can't change my voice. I'm not a professional podcaster. I'm a journalist. Right. And so step the fuck off. And now every time at the end, she's very cute about saying, we love your feedback and comments, unless you're going to tell me you hate my voice, in which case you can just
fuck off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there are so many ads now, and the ads started out, Drew pointed out that it was almost like Only Murderers in the Building, where she didn't even get like MeUndies at first. It was like she was being sponsored by other podcasts.
Well, and then at one point where they're suggesting, just buy us gift cards and send them to us.
And they did.
Which is...
Instead of a Patreon thing.
And maybe, again, maybe it's...
Well, listeners, we want some feedback. Don't send us gift cards. But if you have the desire to send us gift cards, let us know. Because it would be interesting to hear that anybody would ever have that desire.
Well... And so the other thing too is, and I think I texted you and Drew this, isn't it in a little poor taste to be promoting a hunt a murderer game on a podcast about hunting a murderer? It just seems, I don't know. It kind of offends me on a certain level, and I can't quite identify why I have a problem with it, but it really bothers me.
I think it's the same reason that the calling herself a journalist bothers you, because the hunt a killer whatever game is a perfect fit with the true crime podcast, because people who listen to true crime are also like to solve puzzles, and if you can solve a fake crime while you're listening to podcasts about true crimes, then great, you can put your web sleuthing to the test. But yeah, is it if MSNBC was sponsored by The Onion. I mean, is that a good comparison? I mean, that's the kind of thing. It's like, hey, real news sponsored by fake news.
Well, except that as a podcaster, I think you have a lot more control over who you can accept as a sponsor. But I don't think she's discriminating.
Oh no,
I think that's my point.
No, and this is becoming lucrative. I think
she wants to claim journalistic credibility, but then her podcast takes advertising from a content killer. So the podcast is fine as a podcast. That's not what I have a problem with. I have some problems with the podcast, but it's not personal to her. I have some problems with some of the behavior, but again, there's nothing wrong with the podcast. Perfectly fine podcast.
Well, I mean, I guess, okay. So, and I mean, I think we know the answer to this question, but, you know, I mean, would you consider Rachel Maddow a journalist? Would you consider Tucker Carlson a journalist?
I don't consider Rachel Maddow a journalist, not per se.
She's definitely not pure news. Like Shepard Smith is way more of a journalist
than some journalism.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
I don't think she's a journalist. I don't think.
Is the Rachel Maddow show an endeavor of journalism?
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. It's infotainment.
It's exposition.
Yeah.
And it's opinionated. And again, nothing wrong with that. I'm totally fine with that. But I am aware when I watch it that it's political It has a slant. It has a bend. Yes. And that's fine. But she's also not trying to claim that she's some journalistic endeavor. Is she?
I think she would consider herself a journalist. Even though, I mean, she has
she might be a journalist, but I don't think she's claiming the Rachel Maddow Show as journalism.
I don't know. That's a good question.
So, I don't know.
And actually, maybe because the show relies on some journalism, maybe she can I don't know. Well, Miss Maddow, Rachel, Rach, our dog, you are absolutely invited to come on the show.
And oh, yes.
At any point. Educate us, for sure.
I would wet my pants if she came on. Maybe on purpose.
Some people pay extra for that. So I apologize for all of that.
That's the Patreon version.
Yeah, I was going to say, Rachel, no one's going to urinate around you. Anyway. I don't know. It didn't offend me. Mostly, partly because of your and Drew's reaction when I said, hey, you guys need to listen to this. And then you did, and you immediately said, we hate this, or what is this, or whatever. And then both of you are continuing to listen to it, which is, I can't help it. And now, once Drew mentioned it was like only murderers in the building, it's like, oh yeah, it is. It's like she's sort of, you know, kind of, you can see how she's growing as a podcaster. And the story is kind of petering out a little bit because now she has an obligation to update every so often, even when stuff is not happening. Because right now, it could be years before anything actually next happens in this case.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting. So the Murdoch murders. A third of Not in a Creepy Way thought it was delightful, although it had diminishing returns. The further you got along, the less news was happening, and then the more ads you had. There was a lot of ads toward the end. It's like all kinds of ads.
Yes.
Like this. Yes. I don't think she has ever turned down an ad.
Almost as much ad as program in some episodes.
Yeah, and actually, not just ads, but solicitation to advertisers. Would you like to sponsor us? It'll turn our 30-minute podcast into a 45-minute podcast. You want an hour podcast? We just need more sponsors. We're not going to have any extra content, just more ads. So, anyway. I thought that was fun.
I finished that. And then I launched into, what else did I? So, I've now launched into yet another podcast. Damn you. This podcast is unrelated, but I stumbled on it while looking for something else, and so now I'm several episodes in, and I gotta say I'm a little hooked so far. Maybe it'll wear off, but I don't know. I'm 11 episodes in now, so I don't know how many episodes there are. I'm afraid to look now.
I'm screaming. What is the name of this podcast?
I'm dragging you along. I'm keeping you. Oh no,
you're definitely. I'm on tenterhooks.
There's 100 episodes. It looks like. Go fact yourself.
Oh yeah. That's a game show style thing.
Yes.
Yeah. Jimmy Pardo and Danielle Koenig and stuff have been on that, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Lots of people.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a fun concept.
Dave Holmes is on it.
Dave Holmes is great.
And I'm only like 9 episodes in.
Are you listening to his podcast?
No, I can't stand him.
You don't like Dave Holmes?
We've already talked about this. You tried to get me to listen, and I just can't. There's something about him.
Dave Holmes is everything you should love.
We've had this entire
discussion
before.
I know. Yeah.
But anyway, I'm actually, it makes me giggle. This podcast is, the Go Fact Yourself has made me giggle, so it'll probably stay in rotation for a while. I don't know how far I'm going to get into the 100 episodes. I think it's 99 episodes, but I'm enjoying it. It's entertaining. It's good. It's good. I can put my headphones in and do other stuff entertainment, and I can still giggle out of the corner of my brain.
Okay. I've probably already recommended it, but I'm going to recommend it even harder now. Uh-huh. The podcast, How to Survive with Christine and Danielle. Hmm. And what they do is they're both, Christine is scared of everything. And so, you know, she's always scared of, like, you know, earthquakes and tornadoes and tsunamis and stuff. or abductions or whatever. So she's hypervigilant. And Danielle kind of leans sort of the same way. So the first half of their show, they take a topic like earthquakes, right? And then the second, actually, I picked a bad one. I'm trying to think. Okay. The better one is the earthquakes. The first part of the show was wildfires, right? So what to do in a wildfire. And the second half of the show was a comedian talking about getting fired. So it's more of a funny story about like the horror of being fired, and it's funny throughout. But the most recent episode is hypothermia and freezing your balls off, and it is fantastic. It's just a great episode of any podcast, but they're just really funny.
Yeah. Okay,
so How to Survive with Danielle and Christine. If you don't like it, that's fine. Cool, move on. But yeah,
I'm almost guaranteed to like it better than the Murdoch murders.
Oh no, you'll love it there because the my favorite podcast producer, Garen Cockrell, is the producer, and he's the intern on Never Not Funny. And so again, I followed these people around. Like Never Not Funny was maybe the second podcast I ever gave money to subscribe, it was the first one I subscribed to actually. But the second one I sent money to, Horror Etc. was the first podcast I actually sent money to. But yeah, it's really good. It's really good.
Sorry, my laptop's really loud.
Okay, so I have a story for you.
Okay.
So, I've been off, on vacation for, 2 weeks of vacation and 1 week of, people have needed tour trades. And so I stacked up 3 different days I work for other people into another week of vacation.
Oh,
so,
nice.
Yeah, so I was off for 3 weeks, and during that time, it was like minus 20 degrees at night in my fair town, so that's Fahrenheit, and it was fucking cold, and you know, when it's cold and you don't drive your car and your car lives outside, you're going to have a hard time starting it. So I have things like a big jump box battery thing that I'll go out and hook up to it to make sure it starts, and usually I'll either drive it every couple days or start it every day. When it's minus 20, I want to make sure I start it like every single day. Otherwise, I will wake up one morning and not be able to start it because cold winters are hard on car batteries. I also took away any kind of accessories. Like I had a dash cam, but that does not have – even though I'm probably going to – I've never captured an accident on the cam – wouldn't matter now because I don't have it in the car, because if it leaks the least a bit of electricity, if it's a drain at all in the battery, if it's minus 20, the car won't start in the morning. So we don't do that.
What's it plug into?
Just a cigarette lighter.
Oh,
I could have it spliced into the actual battery itself, but
well, that would I was going to say problem. My dash cam plugs into the OBD2 sensor port.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's nice.
And so it shuts off at the point where it would draw too much power.
So it just plugs into that port.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, send me the specs on your dash cam. Cause I want to know. Cause mine, I had to work a wire around.
It's expensive though, because you pay a monthly fee for the plan because it's LTE.
Oh, okay. So it actually stores it on the cloud or something.
And it connects to your phone. So it alerts you if somebody bumps your car, and also you can actually look in your car, like it's internal and external camera, but you can look and speak to the person and say, get the fuck out of my car.
Nice.
So
yeah, that sounds expensive.
I mean, I think the service is $20 a month. Ugh. The camera was,
let me tell you, if I run out of gas, my car is totaled. That's how worthless my car is. So, it's a 20-year-old car.
The nice thing about the cloud though is I can be alerted that I know what's going on with the car, but also like it used to amuse me because Derek would drive my car and I could tell how loud the stereo was because I would turn the camera on and try and say something to him and he couldn't hear me.
That's funny. So one thing I learned from Father Anderson was, to do a pre-flight on my car before I go back to work. So on the Sunday, I return to work on a Tuesday. On Sunday, I'm like, I need to go out and make sure my car starts okay. And because it was cold, it wouldn't start with the remote start because you didn't have that many chances. So I had to go out and put the little jump box on it and start it. And I'm like, well, I'll just drive it around a little bit too, you know, to make, because, you know, when you drive it around, the alternator will charge the battery too. So any little bit helps. So on Sunday, I go and I start the car with the jump box, starts just fine. I realize I can't start it with the remote and just go leave it, because if the hood is open, the remote start won't work. So I have like a gigantic like gallon bottle of iced tea that I just put over the trunk, like hood latch sensor or whatever, so the car thinks the hood is down. So then I can start it by remote and walk off, and nobody can steal the car, right? Because otherwise I have to leave the keys in it. And I did that earlier and just parked Kelly's car behind my car, but we don't have, like, there's no sidewalks in our neighborhood or whatever. So I was putting Kelly's car at risk of getting hit by somebody, and that wasn't good. Anyway, so I started my car, got it started, it was fine. And then I told Kelly, oh, I'm just going to drive it around a little bit, just to, you know, make sure. And I pull it out of the driveway, and, you know, my driveway's got snow on it, so it's a little bumpy sometimes. But it felt like I had at least one, if not all four, flat tires. I'm like, what the hell is this? And so I jump out of the car, and I look at all four tires. My tires are fine. I get back in the car, and I pull it out, and I'm like, oh, I have no power steering. None. So it's like, oh, so, and I thought I had saw like a puddle underneath the car earlier, like the week before or earlier that week, but I just thought it was because I had let it sit in idle. It just melted the snow underneath it. Well, apparently not. So, but luckily our parents are in Hawaii. So my first thought is, oh, crap. So Kelly's got to drive me to work, blah, blah. And Kelly's like, aren't your parents in Hawaii? Can you ask them to borrow one of their cars? I'm like, that's a fantastic idea. So you know, I text mom, and she's like, oh, of course you can. Let me ask your father, because he was napping or something. And I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, that's cool. Yeah, that's great. And of course, he was fine with it or whatever. He's like, hey, take whatever car you're most comfortable with, right? Because they've got an Explorer and an Expedition. And my drive... Turns out I owned an Expedition briefly, and so I know that it's really long. It's a long car, so it would barely fit in my driveway, so I thought I'll just take the Explorer, even though it's the newer car. And so it was great. I was very it was very kind of them to let me use it. I was totally paranoid, as I always am, of driving anybody else's car, because the last thing I want is to, like, you know, trash my mother's brand new car during a time when cars are the most expensive and hard to find. You know, I'm insured and everything, but still. So I'm like, okay, I can drag my car to the shop, at, which is like a block and a half away. Don't have to cross any major road. So I could almost push it there if I had to. So on Monday morning, I call the shop because they're not open the weekends, and they say, hey, yeah, no problem, we'll take a look at it, but we don't have any appointments till Wednesday. And I said, okay, so can I drop the car off on Tuesday night? They go, oh yeah, no problem, you know, put the key in the drop box. I'm like, yeah, no problem. So we go get my mom's car, and, you know, I drive it to work and to home. That's all I do. I haven't driven it anywhere else. But that night on Tuesday after work at 7 o'clock, I come home and I drive my Escape, my 2002 Escape, over to the auto shop, and, you know, no power steering. It's not the end of the world when you're driving at speed.
Yeah,
it's just when you're not driving at speed that's the problem. And I'm sure, you know, depending on what was broken with it, I'm like, oh, driving around with whatever is broken still broken is probably not a good thing. But oh well. You know, because in my mind, it's anything from, oh, you know, somehow I just, like, had a leak in my power steering fluid line, or it's my rack and pinion steering system that's all messed up and it's going to require thousands of dollars. And like I said, if I run out of gas, my car is totaled from insurance. So, you know, pouring thousands of dollars into the car would not be my favorite thing to do. So anyway, all these thoughts running through my brain. So that's fine, right? Drag it over there, fill out the little envelope, put my keys in there. I have a spare key, and I've got actually, I thought about it, but what I didn't do is the spare key has the, like, remote key fob on it, like the valet remote start fob. And I said, oh, I'll just throw that in there too, right? So I've got the key and the valet fob, and I have the regular fob myself. Again, this is a 2002 car. I still got a real kiki. But because I have a remote start, because I live in Alaska, you know. Anyway, so I drop it all off. And the next day is Wednesday. By the way, Journey has had this on again, off again fever for a while. So on Tuesday morning, Kelly's like, she's got a fever again. I'm like, well, she needs to get a COVID test again. So she has to wait an hour and a half in line for a COVID test because COVID is fucking going through her community like a wildfire right now. So on Wednesday, I'm like waiting for the COVID test to come back, because if my daughter comes back positive, then I have to leave work and either go get a test, or if not, then I have to they won't let me back at work for like 10 days if I don't get a test, or 5 days if I do get a test and wear a mask or something. Anyway, it's a whole procedure for it. Luckily, Journey's COVID test came back negative. But it was like 2 o'clock until we got the results of the test on Wednesday, which is way longer than we were used to. And I hadn't heard anything from the automotive shop, which is not unusual. But I didn't want to call them at noon, because I've done that before. And they're like, oh, yeah, we haven't even got to it yet. What are you, why are you like, we'll call you. Trust us. So I'm like, fine, I'll trust you. So at 4:45, they close at 6. At 4:45, I take a break at work and I call them. And say, hey, it's Eric. Dropped my car off. Just wondered if you had a chance to take a look at it. And they're like, we haven't. I'm sorry, but we'll call you right back. I'm like, okay. And then they call me back in the matter of like 5 minutes. They're like, yeah, you didn't drop your key off. We don't have your key. And we're like, I'm like, oh no, I dropped the key off. Oh, where? So I put it in the Dropbox, like in the mailbox, the box behind your shop that says Dropbox on it, where you fill out the envelope and put your keys in and shove it through the slot. And they're like, oh, okay, well, we didn't see it. I'm like, well, that's alarming. So they're like, okay, well, we'll look, we'll let you know. Like, so, and of course, the shop closes in an hour or something, so I didn't hear from them. And immediately I text Kelly saying, they lost my fucking key. I have another key. I can bring them the other key so I get my car fixed. But in the meantime, again, it's 20 years old, but a key is still going to cost me like $150 to get a second key.
If you're lucky.
Yeah. And it's going to cost me $100 to get another valet thing if I want, if I want to. Yeah. Now, I realize modern cars now, like your key fob is probably $1,200 or something.
My key fob was, they made a point of it. It was $700.
Yeah. Yeah. So you don't.
So they warned me, like, you have two of them.
Yeah.
Make sure you know where they are, exactly. Where they are at all times. And I was like, yeah, one of them is never leaving my house, yes. Ever, yep. Ever, ever.
I'm going
ever.
To invest in a safety deposit box, and that's where that's going to sit.
And it's in a drawer downstairs. I know where it is. I look at it almost every day. And boyfriend Jesse is well, I'll just, I can just, no.
Nope. Yeah, no kidding. Yes.
Nope.
Plus, if it falls into the wrong hands, then you're all screwed for all sorts of reasons. So anyway, but that's not the case this, but it was just like, oh my God. Well, I still don't know how much.
As we learned with our mother, having them reprogrammed is not a big deal. It's just time consuming.
Well, and I had, I had a remote start in, it was Kelly's car, now it's my car. And I went and bought, or I had her car when she got a new car. I had her car with her remote start on it for maybe 3 weeks until I dropped the keys in the parking lot. And in the 10 minutes it took me to go back and find them, somebody had driven over them and destroyed the remote start. So I had to go buy. Well, for a while I didn't have a remote start. No, I know. I had the valet one that is janky, and that exploded on me when I was shoveling snow like the year after that. So I finally had to go to an actual auto remote start installation place. And I was like, oh yeah, we'll set you right up. We'll do it right here. It'll take you 10 minutes. It'll cost you $250. Like, motherfucker. For the good remote, or good remote, yeah. Itself and the valet remote. But what am I going to do? Nickel and dime myself to death at that point? No, I want it. Okay, so back to the story. So it's like, great, they've lost my key, whatever. So I was making arrangements with Kelly to, can you go, when you drop Journey out at school, can you go drop off the key? And I'll call them before you do that, blah, blah, blah. So the next morning, I'm teaching, so I have to drive my, of course, freezing rain now, right? It's not minus 20 anymore, it's freezing rain, and I'm borrowing our mother's car. So I have to drive downtown because I'm teaching, and I take a break at like 8:30 in the morning. And I call them and say, hey, it's Eric. First question, did you find my keys? And they're like, oh, yes, we found your keys. it's a table next to the Dropbox and everything's the same color and, you know, whatever. I'm like, ha, you know, it happens, whatever. Again, I'm not that kind of guy. And I would have been that kind of guy, or I would have had Kelly be that kind of girl when she dropped off that second key. Let me tell you. But again, honey, better than vinegar. But then luckily I got a call later in the day saying, yeah, your hose clamp fell off or whatever. And all your fluid drained out. So we reattached your hose and we filled up your thing and burped it and you're good to go. I was like, oh, thank God. Cause I was seriously, I was like, if this costs like over $1,000, like I'm just screwed. I'm not really set up to absorb that kind of thing right at this moment. And we would do it, but it would be painful.
Yeah.
Yeah. But $150. I mean, again, the parts were, it was like 2 quarts or pints or gallons or whatever the increment is to number two of power steering fluid. And that was $130 for labor, which again is fine because I can't burp it myself easily. Anyway, that's something Father Anderson could do, I'm sure. But no, I have no interest in that.
It's the conversation that boyfriend Jesse and I have where I'll do maintenance, low level maintenance on my SUV, although it's on warranty right now, but like I'll do low level stuff. But even after it's off warranty, like I'm not working on it. It's going in. Like I don't, my life is too aggravated right now. I'm not going to spend the time trying to figure out how to, like, no, it's going to the shop.
Yeah.
You know, working on the hot water heater, that was one thing, because that was going to cost us like another mortgage.
Yeah. That's, well, then, man, never mind. There's a podcast about that too. but that, anyway, that's not even the funny part of the story. The funny part of the story is, so it was like, okay, I was teaching, so I got off at 5 instead of at 7, and they closed at 6. So it was like, oh, okay, cool. And unfortunately, Journey had still had a fever, so even though her COVID test came back negative, she wasn't going to school. So I'm like, can you guys, if I go and pay for the car and drive the car home, can you guys give me a ride back to pick up mom's car and then meet me at the parents' home so I can drop her car off, and that way I can be rid of this burden that was, again, absolutely graciously offered to me, and we really appreciate it, like more than anything, saved our bacon for sure. But I wanted to be driving this car for as little time as possible. So drive mom's car back to the parents' house. By the way, I went the back way, kind of like through Lake Otis, because it was rush hour, and again, it was kind of freezing rainy temperatures. So I'm like, nah, I'll just take Lake Otis. There's no reason to get on the highway and, you know, maybe have to make an emergency, like a right. rollover or something, which yes. again was good call, because Kelly and Journey took the highway and I beat them by like 5 minutes to the parents' house, because even though they should have beat me by at least that much, because there was, again, like 5 cop cars and rollovers and stuff all over the place at like Seward and Scooter. But anyway, so the funny part of the story is, though, you're familiar with the parents' garage, right? It's a sizable garage, but they have 2 sizable cars.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, width-wise, it's not super sizable. Length-wise, it's pretty good. Although, again, they've got stuff in there, too.
Yes.
So, Dad has on the left-hand side of the garage, or, well, I guess the right-hand side, if you're looking at it, Dad has his car backed in, and then I am to back in Mom's car on the left-hand side, right? The side where the man door to the house is. Now, with my car, there's a ton of room. Like, if I were to back my Escape, it would be easy to fit because, again, my car is a lot smaller than the Explorer, which actually has a bigger footprint and is wider than I thought it was.
Yes.
And because it's freaking brand new, it's got all of those like collision warning safety things that you had warned me about, I think, when you had driven it the first time.
Yes.
But I had no idea. So I am trying to like crab walk park this car into the garage, right? I'm not going to hit my dad's car with my mom's car, but I also don't want to scratch like my mom's car off on the side of the wall or whatever. Don't worry about that. That couldn't have happened because the car is screaming at me that I am so close to all the walls. It's at first it starts out with a little.
It screams and lights up.
Oh no! It screams. Yeah. It lights up. It lights up in different colors depending on how scary
the severity of the error.
It's like it's showing me all these zones. I feel like it's like Star Trek and like the shields can't hold, Captain.
Yes.
As I am backing up, and of course, at this time, Journey and Kelly had arrived, and there was the dog, Maui.
And there's witnesses.
Well, and they're sitting in the parking lot, and I am like backing up and going forward and backing up and getting out and going to look. It's like, oh no, I'm too far back. Oh, okay. I'm too close. I can barely get out of the car, so I need to change that. So I back it up again, and I get out, and I realize, okay, cool. It's all great, but perfect. Oh no, I'm packed too far in, so now I can't even open the man door to the house. And I get back in the car. What I don't realize is Kelly is inside the car entertaining Journey by saying, like, your dad's, he's going to get back in there, isn't he? Wait, he's going to do. Okay, he's done now. Okay, good. Yeah, he's out. We're fine. He can't. Oh, he surely can't go back in. And Journey is cracking up because, again, I am like crab walking this truck yes. into this fucking garage. And I finally get it like perfect. But I'm a little flustered too. Again, I just want this ordeal. And I didn't realize I was being mocked. But, I did know because I went in and brought some, like, I had my big snow scraper that I had brought along. So I took that back and put it in Kelly's car. And, Journey was still laughing at me. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, yeah. So I go back to drop mom's keys off as the very last thing and then close the door and call it good, right? Make sure the door goes all the way down because I'm not going to have freezer pipes or anything, you know, everything is going to go fine. We get home and Journey is laughing the whole entire time. And then recounting the story is making her laugh even more about how silly I was. It's fine. And we get home and I reach in my pocket and I still have mom's key fob. I had put my Explorer key fob, no, sorry, my escape key pod, you know, the car I just picked up from the shop on her hook in her house. So today after work, I had to go to her house and, change keys, swap keys. And what's funny is I have to admit this to her because they have that like Google camera.
Ring cam. Yeah.
So as I drive up to the house, I'm sure they're like, well, why is Eric there again? Like, and so I'm like pantomiming to the camera. It probably has a microphone, but I don't even think about it. So I'm just like pantomiming, see, I've got your keys. And then anyway, I had to water the plants anyway, so it was fine. But it was like, so altogether, it was a fantastic deal. I mean, it worked out perfectly, even though I would have preferred not to have all my power steering fluid all over the driveway. But if that had to have happened, it happened at the best possible time.
When I was there this last summer, they had not yet disabled all. I shouldn't say all. They had not disabled a couple of the nanny features that I don't have on my car. So I'm not used to some of the features they have on theirs because I don't have the same features.
Yeah.
But one of the features is if it senses an impending impact, either driving forward or in reverse, the car stops. And depending on what you're doing at the time, it's abrupt.
Sure.
When I say abrupt, I mean like, it gives you the impression you have just hit something. So I had been out. I think I ran up to Fred's or something. I think this was when mom was still in the hospital. And I was, of course, I think that whole week was exhausting until she came home. I mean, after it was still exhausting, but I mean, it was stressful and exhausting. So when Dad and I were coming home, it was like, you know, I'm worn out. So I'm trying to back into the driveway and the car and I hit the side of the garage and I'm freaking out. And I get out. I'm like, oh fuck, that's what I need. I get out of the car and look. I'm like, the car's not even close to the girl. What? I don't understand what's going on. Like it felt like I had hit the house.
Yeah.
Because of the violence of the impact of the stop. And I thought, am I so tired that I just hallucinated hitting? Like, this can't be a thing. This can't be happening, right? And so, pull forward, try and back up again, car, bam, stops. And I'm like, motherfucker. So, I realize apparently I'm backing up too quickly, and it thinks that it's going to be a collision because it's extrapolating that I'm going to continue into wherever I'm going. even though because the way they've angled in the garage, I have to turn the car to angle it. So I wasn't going to hit the thing because the car is going to angle away. And anyway, I suggested at one point that I'm like, you know, you maybe move the garbage cans. It might be helpful for both of you because eventually one of you is just going to, one of you mom is going to take that garbage can out or yeah. shove it through the wall.
Oh, I was waiting for me to do that too. I'm like,
so, well, and I know it's probably annoying, but I think it's just, it needs to go somewhere else.
Well, and again, once I figured it out, it was like, okay, I'll just have to like ignore this car screaming at me and be very paying very close attention to what I'm doing. But what's another thing that was funny is the car has all these creature comfort features that I am not used to. It's not just the sensors that say people are coming up on your blind side or whatever. It tells you what the speed limit is on the road you're driving.
Mm-hmm.
It also is all programmed to mom, not only just mom's height or lack thereof, or girth or lack thereof, because if I'm not careful, like if I get in the car and start it,
yes,
it will try to
suffocate you.
Yes, I feel like I need
trash
to have
compactor.
R2-D2 to try to stop it before it crushes me. But the other thing is, I didn't realize, it makes sense. She's got heated seats, and that goes on full blast. She also has a heated steering wheel, and that goes on too.
So that's the heated steering wheel and heated seats are based on the climate outside.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense.
It doesn't always do that.
Okay, I see. So maybe because it was parked outside.
Yeah. So it defaults to there's some climate settings, and they have it set to heat it based on mine does the same thing.
Okay.
So the flip side of it is she also has air conditioned seats, which I also have. So the flip side is in summer that's really useful because seats aren't blisteringly hot. Yeah, I experienced some of that too because I would get in the car with her key fob and it would try and it's like trash compactor.
Oh yeah, yeah. So, no, I almost had an involuntary stomach stapling.
Yeah, yeah. So Jesse and I were discussing when I was there. I think there's something, and I don't want this to be. This is not a criticism. I'm not knocking their Explorer. But their Explorer is designed a little bit differently than mine, and I find theirs very uncomfortable to drive. It doesn't ride the same. It doesn't feel the same. And it's very different, which is funny because it's not that much newer than mine. But I told him, like, I would not buy this. Like, I was having
deluxe, man.
Compared to what I'm going to driving it. Well, I understand, but I'm just like, oh. So now, you know, I'm like, now I don't want to. Now I'm turning into that guy. I'm like, I don't want to buy a new vehicle now. Ugh. So,
although I'm not at risk for that right now. I think if somebody happens to my car that was serious, I'm going to be investing in a skateboard. I'll have to hit up Jesse for skateboard advice.
He's all kinds of skateboards, so.
Yeah. Yeah. What can get a portly gentleman to work and back? Something in a longboard? I don't know.
I got nothing.
Actually, as an old portly gentleman, all I would have to do is fall off that skateboard once, and I would be taking an ambulance. So,
I'd say you'd be in a wheelchair then.
Yeah, yeah.
Motor scooter.
Hey, they have those motorized wheelchairs. They're pretty zippy. I've seen them zipping around town.
Well, they're zippy until the batteries die.
Yeah, well, if you're going to be like waving down help, better to be in a wheelchair. You get better attention. Anyway, other than you're just a fat guy laying next to a skateboard on the side of the road, you can have less people stop to help you. Anyway, so yeah. So, again, it turned out to kind of be a relatively non-event, but I'm very grateful to our parents that I had the ability to borrow their car. Anyway, anything else?
Let's see. Boyfriend Jesse and I had this discussion the last, because this has been a trend the last 3 or 4 weeks since we've been back from Alaska, that I've noticed when I go into the grocery store, shelves are empty.
Oh, yeah.
There's lots of stuff that's out. Yes. And I am not used to that as an American shopping consumer. I mean, it's concerning. It's alarming. And I told Jesse, I said, I'm not really super worried yet, but it's starting to make me nervous.
It makes me remember the toilet paper panic of 2019 or whatever, right?
I'm kind of like you. So I do the Fred Meyer click list or whatever it is.
Love
it. And then based on the substitution list that they tell me, I stop at the Safeway on my way before I go to Fred's.
Exactly.
And then I have this loop.
Yeah.
And so I'm sure I look like a crazy lunatic, but the last couple of times I've gone into Safeway, they didn't have the things that the Fred's was out of either. So I'm like, well, shit, what do I do now?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, because some of the stuff's like staples stuff. It's not like
eggs. Milk, yeah. By the way. Another thing was milk. There was no milk. I mean, there actually, you could buy expensive milk, like organic, like whatever, but the regular milk, but also no half and half, no whipped cream, no chocolate milk. No, there's no nothing but like $6 a gallon organic,
pea milk.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, like I said, there were four packs of the kind that I got, and I think maybe two half cartons of another brand of pre-hard-boiled eggs, but no fresh eggs. Yeah. I mean, it feel like chopped. It's like, I'm going to have to look and see, can I find eggs in a can someplace? You need to be making a barbecued burger, but there is no beef, so you're going to have to use haggis and Vienna sausages.
You know, Jesse used to tease me, I think, when we moved, because when we were packing up the pantry, he's like, what do you have powdered milk for? And I said, well, the real reason I have it for is because it's used in some bread recipes to make bread.
Yeah.
But the other reason is backup.
Yeah.
Because in worst case, as much as it's not the best thing to drink, and it's not, I mean, there's no illusion that it's the great thing to drink. It's acceptable as milk if in a pinch.
It reminds me of our grandmother, though.
That it does. Yeah. It reminds me of my childhood.
Yeah.
It wasn't awful. I mean, it wasn't fantastic, but better than putting water on my Cheerios, right?
Yeah.
So, it's been a little concerning. So, but then, you know, there's that. And then the other real big thing right now is on that little tattle on your neighbor's app. I don't know if you're involved in that.
Well, I hear about it. It may impact my work life a little bit.
I'm on it, but I'm not readily identifiable who I am or where I live because
99% of the people are lurking, which is on purpose. You should
turns out I don't think I like a lot of my neighbors. So I don't say much, if anything, but it's good to know what's going on. Like I knew somebody's car got broken into and somebody's yard.
No. Let me tell you, occasionally Mrs. Kravitz had a juicy story to tell.
But somebody was like, earlier tonight, I was sitting at my computer in the living room, and I heard the dog. Some it sounded like a dog in distress, right? And so I heard it, and then it stopped. And I thought, oh, okay, well, somebody's taking care of it. Yeah, well, it was a coyote that got somebody's dog.
Oh, ooh.
So I told boyfriend Jesse, I said, as you take the dog out, you probably want to be really hyper-vigilant because the dog, by the way, has wanted out all day long.
Oh, sure.
He wants out there.
Dog can smell a coyote.
And so I said, you know, you need to be careful because there could be a coyote in the yard. And there is a gap between the bottom of our fence and the yard. So ostensibly, a coyote could squeeze through. So I'm like, be really careful because the coyotes are probably hungry. It's been a weird season. So I imagine they're looking for food, especially if they just got the neighbor's dog.
I don't wish for coyotes, but I would love to get one of those coyote vests for my dog. The ones with like the big spikes on them. Have you seen them?
No, I didn't know that was a thing.
I'll send you. I mean, I think your dog is way too big to necessitate one of these. But it looks like a Mad Max uniform. Like it looks like one of those like winter coats you put on your dog, but it's got these huge don't know, they're fiberglass maybe? Like spikes coming out of it. So it looks like a porcupine. And the idea is, are you looking it up?
No. I'm okay, listening.
Yeah. No, I'll send you a picture or whatever. But okay. Yeah, it's pretty imposing. I mean, it's like the dog that would wear that casually also probably has an earring. So.
Anyway, so that's all that's really going on here. I don't go. Monday's a holiday, yes. So I don't go back to work till Tuesday. So Jesse's really excited because we have a common day off, which is nice. Monday. So he's thrilled.
Nice,
but otherwise it's just whatever. And I don't have to watch my movie for next week because I already watched it. So
perfect. So take a listen if you got a second to bear. If you like, subscribe, you can even share. Films on films, discuss on air. It's a brother podcast. We're going to leave it right here. Take a listen if you got a second to bear. If you like, subscribe, you can even share. Films on films, discuss on air. It's a brother podcast. We're going to leave it right here. One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you want to catch an episode. They talk movies, so they go off on a tangent flow and maybe ramble. That's a brother Sanderson. So sit back with closed eyes. Let them take you away unless you're driving. Keep them open in that case. We got Eric, Drew, and Brother Jay. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way. Hey. Not in a creepy way. Not in a creepy way.